Welcome to How to Stop Climate Change. I'm your host, David Butler, and I'm joined by my co-host, Matt Russell, and my producer and daughter, Keaton Butler.
Our guest today is Carly Matthews from the American Conservation Coalition, a nonprofit organization which educates and empowers conservatives to re-engage in environmental conversations by promoting a mix of free market, pro-business, and limited government environmentalism. But first, since we're also starved for human interaction because of quarantine, and David and Matthew haven't talked to anyone aside from their dogs in months, I'll let them start us off with some good old pre-show banter.
Hi, Matt. How are you doing today?
Very well, David. How are things?
Good. I'm here stuck at home during COVID, of course, and recording from my linen closet studio.
Doing exactly the same thing. Looking forward to restrictions lifting and getting back to normal.
Yeah. So what's going on today?
Got a great interview today. Really looking forward to it. We've got Carly Matthews in, who comes from the Republican and conservative side of the debate. So really looking forward to seeing what she's got to say.
I'm pretty excited about it, too. And I was a little kind of wary of talking to somebody on the right about climate change.
Yeah, would have been the same. I find it a bit more exciting, I think, in that it's a great opportunity to hear what the right are thinking, how they're feeling. And it breaks down that barrier a little bit and thinking of it as just one big monolith of denial. Nice to hear a positive voice coming out of it.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't agree with every single thing they have on their platform. Certainly, there's a lot of talk about a very limited role for government. You could debate how limited that role needs to be. But I think it's really encouraging that young people in the Republican Party are standing up and saying this is real and we have to act on this. And I think it's incredibly important for the future of the party. You know, if all the ancient stubborn climate denier guys just continue to say, no, the Republican Party is going to obstruct any progress on climate change, then they won't be around very long.
Yeah, might be a small constituency at the moment of climate advocates, but that's going to grow with time. And it's just good politics to go after that vote. And particularly to see someone like this leading it within that party, delighted to see it.
Yeah. Anything else we should mention before we leap into the interview?
Yeah, worth noting that Michael Moore's documentary is down for copyright infringement.
Yeah, my understanding is that they used some footage that they thought they should be able to use under the fair use laws, but the creator didn't like the message that was being tied to his footage because that was not the intention of his footage, and so he objected to that. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. I mean, I guess worst case scenario, they'll replace that footage and put the movie back up.
No doubt it'll be back up in no time. Either the footage will be replaced or there'll be an appeal and it'll be back up again. It's important to mention, I don't think this has anything to do with censorship, which I have seen that argument being made online. It's not the case. This is straightforward copyright infringement and it'll be quickly resolved and they'll move on.
Yeah, I saw the filmmakers trying to claim that this was part of some sort of conspiracy to take their movie down. But I think it's just evidence that they were sloppy and didn't have everything nailed down.
Agreed. Anyhow, will we get into it?
Yeah, let's go.
Let's go.
Hi, we're here with Carly Matthews from the American Conservation Coalition. How are you doing today, Carly?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
Well, we're glad to have you on the show and excited to learn a little bit more about the American Conservation Coalition. How did it get started?
Absolutely. So our founder, Benji Backer, started the American Conservation Coalition in 2017, and he kind of saw this gap in the market of ideas in the environmental conversation, and he wanted to re-engage conservatives and their principles in environmental discussions and policy conversations. He felt as though the conversation was being dominated by principles that are more left-leaning, and he wanted to re-engage his ideology and his peers on the issue.
So how many founders were there with Benji when the organization first started?
So Benji is our sole founder. He obviously built a team around him, and now we have more than 40 volunteers and getting close to 10 full-time staffers, but he is our sole founder.
Is it a membership organization?
We do have a membership program. So there are three different tiers. There's a student membership, which is free, a young professional membership, and a general membership. Both of those have a fee associated with them. But basically, being a member of ACC allows people to have a little bit more access to our content. There are certain events that we give members priority registration for, and they just get to be a part of our community talking about limited government and market-based environmentalism.
So what are the objectives for the organization?
So our major objective is to re-engage conservatives in environmental conversations, and that largely means talking about climate change, that means talking about conservation and our national parks, and you know, a whole host of environmental issues that we're facing as a nation and also as a world. A lot of these problems are global problems, not just centered in the United States. And we also do specifically a lot of youth outreach. So we also have kind of a sister organization that's a 501c3 educational program called the American Conservation Coalition Campus. And we have student representatives on more than 200 campuses nationwide. And they put on programming on their campuses. They table outside and engage their fellow students on the issues. And we've had a lot of success re-engaging conservative students and honestly students in general on these issues.
Is it fair to say that there's an age divide in your organization? Is it a generally young group of people? Is it split right across the various age groups on the right? Where are you seeing most of the focus coming from at the moment within your group?
Yes, so we absolutely focus on the younger generations. Our members range from kind of age 15 to in their mid to late 20s. But we absolutely do have allies of older generations, whether that's Gen X or there absolutely are baby boomers who are responsive to our message. But we do focus on young people. And actually in February, we did some polling of 18 to 35-year-olds. And this sample came from like a host of various political affiliations and ideologies. And we found that 87% of all these respondents agreed that the United States should pursue climate policies that increase economic prosperity and decrease global greenhouse emissions. So we found that young people, regardless of partisanship, really care about these issues and want to see effective solutions.
And did you get the sense, I think you alluded to this earlier on, that this might be more of a political question than strictly a climate one, but that the left-hand side of the debate, it's a very big policy area for them, and that maybe the right has, if not made an error, maybe it is now looking at re-engaging with those policy decisions, because there's a lot of voters out there from both sides who see this as an important issue that does possibly need more attention from the right. Is that fair, or am I oversimplifying it?
I think that's fair. What we really focus on is the fact that a lot of people agree that this is an issue, and now we can talk solutions. And we can disagree on exactly which solution is going to work better. People have different principles that they, you know, base their ideologies on, and that kind of guides what type of solution they favor. But we can agree that climate change is an issue and we need to pursue solutions.
Do you have challenges on the right with people pushing back against you from the climate change perspective? Like, we live in a world now where there's no middle ground anymore. You have people hard left who believe the whole world is burning down around us, and you have people on the hard right who believe that this is all a hoax. Is there a growing change in attitudes, or are you still facing a bit of pushback on the climate side that this isn't a real thing and that it is a fraud?
What I find more often than kind of outright denial is that people on the right, specifically I'm talking about now, recognize that it's a problem and that we should care for our environment, we should reduce our emissions, but they don't want to do so at the expense of economic development and economic prosperity. So ACC really works to emphasize that environmental sustainability and economic prosperity don't have to be at odds. We can pursue both at the same time, and it's imperative that we pursue both at the same time. Almost 3.3 million Americans worked in clean energy by the end of 2018. Those are American jobs that we should be promoting, and they're also good for the environment. So I think that's an argument that a lot of conservatives respond to. It's like, okay, I want to care for the environment, but you know, I want to have a job and I want the economy to be doing well. Well, we can have both. And I think that that's been a really important distinction that ACC has made.
I'm certainly on board with that. Are there any particular areas within the market that you're looking at where you can see developments that are available now or that we could move on quite easily and start to generate either a return on that investment or start to make a big difference to the carbon content in the atmosphere?
Absolutely. So ACC is very in favor of safe nuclear development. Obviously, we have a history of nuclear development that has not been safe, but with further research and development, nuclear energy is getting safer and safer. And nuclear is actually 20% of the United States carbon-free electricity, which is extremely significant. And we can't reduce emissions without developing nuclear energy further. We also think that developments in carbon capture technology are very promising. That, of course, is not really at the deployment stage at this point, but we're certainly encouraged by carbon negative technologies like that. There's also legislation promoting research and development into battery storage, which would help renewables be more marketable because obviously solar panels are more successful when it's sunny. So we could store that energy and use it when it's cloudy. And that would definitely help renewables be more affordable and the energy that comes from renewables to be more abundant.
I don't want to go down a whole rabbit hole about nuclear energy because it's definitely possible to do so. And it's such a controversial issue. And I understand that there are pros and cons in both directions. But do you think that we really have time for nuclear to be a big part of the solution? I mean, it takes so long to develop new nuclear plants and there's so much expense. The projects are almost always over budget and over schedule. So how big a piece of the solution do you think nuclear is actually going to be?
It's a great question. And I think that it is important to say that nuclear energy on its own is not going to, reduce all of our carbon emissions. It certainly is only a piece of the puzzle. And a reason why we emphasize so much the research and development side of nuclear, or carbon capture, battery storage, is because we want these technologies to be developed more so that they're more marketable. They don't need the subsidies that come along with, deploying a technology before it's really at an appropriate market value. I think that nuclear really has to be a part of the solution. You're right that it does take more time than setting up solar panels or other technologies like that. But I think that we have to put more emphasis on researching nuclear so that we can lower the costs, we can, lower the time investment that it takes. But I certainly think it has to be a part of the plan.
What would you like to see our overall power mix be between now and 2050?
Right. So fossil fuels aren't going away overnight, and they can't because we need them for our energy consumption that we currently have. Nuclear and renewables total to about 19% of our energy consumption, and then we get into natural gas and coal. So those aren't going to go away overnight. We do absolutely want to promote, renewable technologies like solar and wind, hydropower, biomass, geothermal. All those sources are really important. There's not going to be kind of one source that is the saving grace. We're really going to have to pursue an all of the above approach. And, solar panels work really well in California, where we get a lot of sun. Maybe in Washington State, when it's really cloudy all the time, solar panels aren't the right choice. Maybe we should pursue hydro there. Nationwide, it's really going to be a mix. It's going to be all of the above. And state by state, we're going to have to kind of experiment of what energy source works the best with the conditions we have there.
Let's talk a little bit about the role of government. I know a big part of your platform is that we can't expect government to solve all of our problems. And I agree with that. And Matt and I have certainly talked a lot about how business is important. We need to find ways to make it profitable to go green. And I think that's already happening. But what role do you see government playing?
Government absolutely has a role. Certainly, we believe in a limited government approach, but some protection for the environment has to exist on the federal level. Where we really see government coming in is incentivizing research and development, partnering with private industry to develop something like carbon capture, to develop battery storage. We see government as kind of like the hand up for industry to really go green and develop technologies that are going to help us actively reduce emissions. We don't see government kind of imposing mandates that may or may not really be feasible for companies, for industries to abide by. We really see them as kind of, you know, incentivizing innovation and development.
Do you think it's possible to, let me start that over and then I'll give you the next one, Matt. So I see that government is necessary kind of to set the rules for the playing field, you know, and I agree with you that they shouldn't be necessarily controlling exactly how we're going to reach our goals. But if we don't have some serious rules about emissions and environmental degradation, then the companies that don't care about the environment in a lot of situations will have a higher profit margin than the companies that do. So you've got to have some kind of ground floor, and I don't see how you can have that without some sensible government regulations.
Sure. That's a fair point. I think where we come at kind of the business side of addressing the environment and climate change is that we really believe that people vote with their dollars. So we're talking about consumer demands. Countless companies are really going for net zero emissions by 2050 because their consumers are demanding it. So that includes BP, Microsoft, Nestle, really a whole host of companies. So even if the government isn't setting these rules, we've found that companies are doing it anyway because it's what consumers are demanding. And then the government kind of steps in to partner with industries and companies that are doing really good work to incentivize that and show that, you know, there is a reward for going green. And we kind of believe in the carrot, not the stick in that situation.
Okay, I lied, Matt. I'm going to ask one more question and then I'll let you go. I like that. I like that approach. I do think the carrot is better than the stick. Unfortunately, at the moment, we're still giving massive subsidies to fossil fuel companies. And there's always huge resistance in Congress and from the fossil fuel industries anytime there's a subsidy for renewable energy. And then they happily forget that they are receiving a lot of subsidies. I think the most conservative estimate that I've seen is $20 billion per year in the U.S. and 55 billion euros per year in the EU. And that doesn't make sense to me. What do you think we should do about that?
Absolutely. So actually, ACC's Executive Vice President, Daniel Butcher, wrote an op-ed on this exact subject. It was published on Sunday. And she said, you know, as we're considering stimulus, amid the COVID-19 pandemic, we're talking about giving more money to fossil fuels when we've lost 600,000 jobs in clean energy. And if we continue to for lack of a better word, bail out the fossil fuel industry when clean energy is also suffering, clean energy is never going to be able to be competitive. And you're absolutely right. When Congress talks about giving subsidies to solar, for example, there's a big outcry. But coal and natural gas do get subsidies. And to be clear, those industries support American jobs. We need the energy produced from coal and natural gas. But we also need to pursue cleaner forms of energy. So you're right. That's definitely a balance that we need to strike between, okay, we need to power our country, but we also need to pursue cleaner solutions.
We'll be right back after this short break. In order to reverse climate change, we need to emit less and remove the rest. A few episodes ago, we spoke with Alden Donnelly from Nori, a company that is doing just that. Nori is a virtual marketplace for carbon removal retention credits. When you purchase a carbon removal credit, that represents 1 ton of carbon dioxide that has been removed from the atmosphere and put into the soil. Farmers can register their carbon removals on the Nori marketplace, and people just like you can pay for ownership of the carbon removed from the atmosphere, making it incredibly easy to participate in reversing climate change. If you want to learn more about offsetting some of your carbon footprint, visit nori.com. That's N-O-R-I.com.
Carly, just going back to the current administration in particular, are there members of Senate or the Congress or any of the government institutions for that matter that we should be paying more attention to on this subject that are perhaps positive advocates or spokespeople for environment in general or climate, but environment generally, that maybe aren't getting enough press, or that maybe people on the left aren't listening to enough, that actually are advocating strongly for a positive environmental change and we should be giving them a little bit more airtime?
Yeah, thank you for that question. Absolutely. There are some really great representatives and senators who are advocating for conservation issues, climate issues, energy issues on the right side of the aisle that we just don't hear about. And not only that, but they're working across the aisle. There is just a whole host of bipartisan legislation that encourages energy innovation for renewables, for carbon capture technology, for battery storage technology, for nuclear technology. And that legislation is often introduced by a Republican, supported by both Republicans and Democrats. Some examples that come to my mind right away are Representative Brian Mast out of Florida. He's done some great conservation work around oceans. Obviously, Florida feels the effects of climate change more acutely than some other states do. He's really being a leader on the issues. Out of Alaska, Senator Lisa Murkowski, who's the chair of the Senate Natural Resources Committee, is an incredible leader on environmental issues. She was instrumental in the passage of S-47 in the beginning of last year, which was a historic land package that the president ultimately signed into law. Also out of Alaska, Senator Dan Sullivan has been instrumental in the Save Our Seas Act, which addresses marine debris, very important environmental issue. We see a lot of young members of the House, like Representative Elise Stefanik out of New York, who really lead on this issue and know that their constituents care about the environment and that they need to be a leading voice.
It's really positive to hear that level of cooperation between the different sides of the aisle. And then that links in, hopefully, to the sort of initiatives we're going to see to help with the market developing and bring these technologies to the consumer and create a space where companies can really grow and develop whatever solutions they have that tie in with the sort of initiatives you've just discussed. Are you seeing that same level of bipartisanship amongst consumers, voters, the genuine general community, or is there still divisiveness there?
I think absolutely we live in a very divisive time in politics, especially American politics. But I do think that the environment and climate change really has the ability to unite people. We have one planet. It's our common denominator, no matter where you live, what you do for a living, who you vote for. You live on this planet and you want to continue to do so in a healthy manner. So I think that talking about climate as something that we all share is really effective. And like I mentioned before, we did do polling in February, and it was really astounding how respondents of all different political affiliations from different regions of the country, from various ages from 18 to 35, really thought that this is an issue that should be prioritized. 90% of independents said that climate change is important to them. That's very telling in the fact that we all want climate action. We all want to pass along a planet that is ready for our children and our grandchildren. So even though it is a really divisive time between presidential politics and even COVID-19 is causing division, I think that our environment really has the ability to unite us.
You know, I think there, it used to be that this was a relatively bipartisan issue. And certainly a lot of Republican presidents and congressmen were responsible for some of our most important environmental actions in the United States. Richard Nixon rolled out the EPA. Teddy Roosevelt came up with the national parks. But then at a point in maybe the 80s, it became much more political when climate denial started to be a big thing. What are your thoughts on, you know, just now getting around to the point where we're starting to see some bipartisanship? We've lost like four decades due to climate denial and political gridlock on these issues that I think was completely unnecessary and only to the benefit of the fossil fuel companies. Do you feel like they should be held accountable for that? There are lawsuits being raised against them, you know, weekly now.
Yeah, speaking on behalf of myself, not necessarily ACC, I'm 22, so I was not around in the 80s. I cannot say for sure, you know, what really changed, that climate denial really gained some traction in this country. Certainly we've lost time, but I think that the most beneficial thing for us to do from here is to continue bipartisan, nonpartisan cooperation. I'm not sure really what the benefit would be to, as I mentioned before, kind of use a stick instead of a carrot. I think right now we need to move forward and pursue solutions that are going to reduce carbon emissions today. From my perspective, kind of suing a fossil fuel company is not going to reduce emissions today. So I think that our focus should really be on solutions at this point.
Do you see, Carly, when you're working within the community and when you've carried out these polls or done research into behaviors and attitudes, that people are beginning or willing to take individual responsibility for their own actions and make decisions as individuals, but with an awareness of the effect it's having on the environment around them? So beyond talking points or a bit of virtue signaling, that literal change is something that's beginning to take place in these communities.
I think so, absolutely. And I think that companies are taking note that people want to live more sustainably. So now you can buy toothpaste that doesn't come in a plastic tube. They're like little pellets almost that dissolve in water, and you can brush your teeth that way. There are cleaning supplies that work similarly. Companies like Starbucks are using recycled materials to make their coffee cups, or they're giving you a discount if you use a reusable cup when you purchase coffee from them. So I think that there is this movement to live more sustainably, and that's becoming more mainstream. It's becoming more affordable because consumers are demanding that companies give them sustainable options. For example, I don't use disposable Keurig cups. I have a reusable cup and I use ground coffee in it. And then after I brew my coffee, that can be used, you know, on plants. I kind of throw it outside to our bushes in the front yard. So that's really kind of an individual choice. Obviously, I'm not solving climate change. I'm not under any impression that, you know, I'm reducing all the plastic use in the world. But I think that people collectively are deciding to live more sustainably when it's in their means.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the idea of the personal responsibility perspective of it and making purchasing decisions that align with my own conscience and where I want to go with my view of the environment. It must be put to you, however, because it's certainly put to me, we do all of these wonderful things. We make all of these efforts in the US, Canada, even Europe. And then somebody throws it straight back at me, well, look, doesn't make what difference we make. If they don't change their attitudes and behaviors in China or India, the whole thing is lost. Anyway, how do you answer those sorts of charges that small changes or whatever changes we make on our behalf don't really matter on the global scale?
It's an interesting question, and I don't know that I would say that they don't matter, because consumer behavior influences business behavior, and obviously that makes change happen on a larger scale. And when it comes to global action, the United States accounts for 15% of global carbon emissions, which obviously is not all global carbon emissions. If we reduce all of ours tomorrow, there's still 85% of carbon emissions still going into the air. So I think the answer here is that we have to work globally. We have to think globally. When the United States is working in research and development and working on deploying technologies that are going to reduce emissions, we have to think about how can we make this affordable and export to countries that are also creating waste that is going into our oceans or, you know, filling up landfills. How do we think globally and think about solutions that are not going to just work in the United States, but work on a global scale? I think that that's a really important piece of the puzzle. And as I said before, it's not beneficial for this to be a blame game. We can't sit here in the United States and say, okay, well, China is polluting more than us, so we don't have to do anything. That doesn't yield results. If China is not doing enough, then we need to work harder to engage with China to address climate change, to reduce their emissions. We can't just kind of point fingers and move on with our day. That's not going to benefit anyone.
Well, I think it's also really disingenuous, because most of China's carbon footprint is probably related to manufacturing consumer goods for the West.
After a little research, I can confirm my dad's assumption. In fact, about one quarter of China's gross domestic product comes from exports. Export goods emissions account for 1.7 billion tons of China's carbon dioxide, which represents 6% of total global emissions. That's the equivalent of Germany, France, and the UK's combined emissions.
So, you know, that's kind of silly to say, why should we do anything if China isn't? And on the other hand, they've manufactured and installed way more solar than anybody else.
Yeah, absolutely. We have to think in a way that is globally minded and that promotes solutions that work everywhere. It doesn't make sense for the United States to not take a leading role and show how we can develop technologies, how we can reduce emissions. It doesn't make sense for us to fall behind on this issue.
Maybe that's a good place to talk about the American Climate Contract. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So ACC introduced the American Climate Contract on April 21st, the day before Earth Day. And this is our framework, basically our platform for market-based climate action. It's not outright legislation, but we did identify legislative measures already introduced in the House and Senate that kind of fit within the framework. So it's based on four different pillars, which are energy innovation, 21st century infrastructure, natural solutions, and global engagement. So this means innovating and taking a pro-market approach to climate change and reducing our carbon emissions. The goal is reducing carbon emissions. It's not saying a bunch of flowery things that end up being just rhetoric. We want to pursue solutions that are actually going to reduce our carbon footprint.
Is it an answer to the Green New Deal to an extent?
To an extent, I think it's similar in that they're both kind of platforms. The Green New Deal isn't necessarily actionable legislation. I think Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez called it a non-binding resolution recently. So it is similar in that way. But we really want to emphasize that we're kind of going on offense, and we want this to be a real solution that anyone, regardless of partisanship, can get behind. So in that way, I would say it's a little bit distinct from a Green New Deal.
Yeah, I wanted to take that a little bit further, because I think it ties in nicely with something you mentioned earlier on with regards to the global reach of these initiatives. Like, America still is a really global superpower when it comes to the economy and culturally. If you're able to take a lead and put yourself out in front of the rest of the world with some of these initiatives, they will spread, and they will not just work for businesses, but will work for communities and cultures across the world. I think lots of people will embrace them. But to get back into some of the specifics, I think you mentioned energy earlier on. We spent a little bit of time on that. When you talk about infrastructure, transport is one of the things that occurs to me there. What sort of proposals are you making, or what sort of changes would you like to see?
Absolutely. So the United States has pretty outdated infrastructure, whether that be energy grids, public transit, even personal transit like automobiles. And we're kind of proposing that we need to update to the 21st century. We need to deploy smart grids. We need to pursue solutions that will make public transit cleaner than it is. And that's really important because if we're producing clean energy, if we've innovated in the energy sector and we have, you know, deployable nuclear energy, if we have renewables that are more marketable, that's great. But if we don't have the infrastructure to get that energy from point A to point B, then we're kind of losing some of the benefits of clean energy.
So that's the idea of a smart grid. So we're making sure we're using that energy effectively, delivering it into the various transport options that are needed, as an example, and then battery storage on top of that to make sure we're not wasting anything or losing anything unnecessarily.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, let's talk about you a little bit, Carly. How did you get interested in this?
Right. So I grew up in a really teeny tiny rural town in southern Pennsylvania. Just to give you a little bit of context, there's no red light. And actually this week on the news, there was a cow loose in the town. So that kind of sets the scene for you. So growing up, I think kind of needless to say, climate change wasn't something I thought about a lot. I didn't grow up in a city where, you know, we're talking about emissions. Climate change kind of came up once a year in the science class. But I remember being younger and just really enjoying the outdoors. My parents have a really large backyard that I love to go out in. My dad's a sportsman, so I've always had kind of a respect for nature because of him. So in college, I became really passionate about the conservative movement and got politically active. But I realized that, you know, we didn't talk about environmental issues very much. And so kind of through my personal network, I found ACC. It was about a year after it was founded in the summer of 2018. And I got involved and I really was not very knowledgeable. I didn't know what I was talking about when it came to these issues. And ACC provided me with the tools to talk about climate change, to talk about conservation. And I became really inspired by this network of people who care about climate change, but also have principles that were very similar to me. So that was just really transformative, honestly, for me. And I just graduated from college about 2 or 3 weeks ago. It was a nice online ceremony due to COVID-19. And this is my full-time job now. So I think it's so important because climate change and the environment is an issue that young people specifically are really going to have to reckon with. We have a long future on this planet, and especially, you know, for our children and our grandchildren, we need to pursue a cleaner future for them and for ourselves. So ACC really kind of catapulted me into my career and also into my passion, which is really cool.
Yeah, it's fantastic to have a job that you really feel good about, where you feel like you're making a positive difference in the world.
Absolutely.
What would you say to other young Republicans or young voters in general about what you think they should do to get the establishment moving on this issue? Because they've been dragging their feet for decades, not just on the right, just government in general.
Yeah, absolutely. ACC does various call to actions where we ask our activists to send letters and emails and phone calls into their representatives. We've hosted fly-ins with young conservatives in which some of them meet face-to-face with their representatives and talk about these issues and why they're important to them. I think it's really important to be vocal and tell your representatives what's important to you. As someone who was a former congressional intern, I can tell you that, you know, the staff sees the volume of emails and calls that representatives and senators get about various issues, and those numbers are elevated. And it's really important, even if you don't think an email or a call is going to do anything, you're adding your voice to kind of this chorus of constituents who want solutions. And I think if we show our representatives, no matter what their partisanship is, that this is something that we more or less hired them to do. And we want them to pursue solutions to climate change and environmental issues, then they won't have a choice. We can literally vote them out of office. So I think it's really, really important to engage with your elected representatives.
How long do you think that shift is going to take in the Republican Party? Do you think that Mitch McConnell is ever going to make this a key issue, or will we have to wait until some people are retired?
Kind of ACC's philosophy about this is we can't wait until we have like this ideal condition to act on climate change. We have to continuously move the needle. And while Mitch McConnell is, you know, not really engaging on climate change or environmental issues as much as some other leaders in the House and Senate, he did agree to vote on the Great American Outdoors Act, which would start to address the $12 billion maintenance backlog on the National Park Service. So we are moving the needle. Even President Trump signed public lands packages and the Save Our Seas Act. We can't wait until we have kind of this perfect candidate in the White House and in leadership in Congress. It's got to be gradual. And I don't know exactly how long it's going to take until literally every member of Congress prioritizes the issue, but we're certainly making progress as it is.
That's exciting.
Yeah, I'm really encouraged. There's a lot we found out today. And it, for me as an outsider completely, to see part of a narrative that isn't discussed at all in the media, it's been wonderful to get an insight into it. And it's really encouraging to hear that you're finding as much engagement across the board when you go out with this topic to meet with people as you are, and that we are seeing it reflected in our leaders with cross-party cooperation on various bills, initiatives, or as the market develops, the politicians will follow. That's always been the case, and I'm sure it won't change.
Yes, absolutely. From my perspective, there's a lot of hope out there. We talk about kind of the doom and gloom of climate change, but it's really an opportunity for us to work together and pursue solutions that are bipartisan and honestly nonpartisan.
That's a great message. Well, thanks so much for talking with us today, Carly.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode of How to Stop Climate Change, please give us a review or share the show with a friend. If you'd like to support the show, please head over to howtostopclimatechange.com/support. All donations will go to cover expenses and help me pay my daughter, Keaton, for all the time she spends editing and producing the show. I couldn't do this without her.
Music for this episode was done by Avery Reedy and myself, Keaton Butler. Our theme music is by Juices.